You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Good to have you listening this morning. I recently caught an interview in which film director and amateur magician J.J. Abrams described a singular experience that made him question the power of illusion. He told the story of watching a magician do a trick that was so accomplished and so confounding that Abrams thought to himself, maybe he really is magical. Our guest Shankar Vedanta might call what Abrams felt the pleasure and the power of self-delusion, a delightful departure for the film director from the reasonable and rational. Mr. Vedantam writes in his new book, "We must certainly be informed by reason, rationality, and science, but we must also deploy the insights of logic, using aspects of our minds that are prone to storytelling, symbols, and self-deception." And that's our conversation today. Why our brains are engaged in a push and pull between logic and delusion. I thought it would be fun to hear from you. Can you think of the last time you or someone you love engaged in a little harmless self-delusion? As I was talking with Kathy, maybe you bought a face cream and you believed it truly would make you look 20 years younger. Maybe you fell madly in love and you believe your partner is the most wonderful person on earth. Tell us about your self-delusion, and Shankar and I welcome your questions too. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Shankar Vedantam is the host of the Hidden Brain Public Radio podcast and co-author of the new book, Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. Shankar, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Carrie, thank you so much for having me. It's such a delight to be here.
It's a delight to have you. What do you think of that story that I told about J.J. Abrams? And by the way, he's an amateur magician himself, so he knows about the power of illusion. And yet for a moment he thought, that guy's got something I don't, and it's magical.
I have to say, I have been a huge fan of magic and magicians since the time I was a kid, and I've never really outgrown it. There is something truly wonderful about a beautiful magic trick, and it has that the effect that J.J. Abrams described, the feeling like, you know, all kinds of things are possible that you didn't think were possible, and you have a sense of wonder and awe. Over the last 20 or 30 years, as I have become a science journalist and have delved more deeply into the workings of the human mind, I've realized there is another kind of magic trick that unfolds around us all the time. This one does not come with a cape or with someone waving a magic wand, and it doesn't end with applause. In fact, it's just the way that our brains perceive reality. We don't realize that it's a magic trick, and in some ways, it might be the most profound magic trick of all, because in fact, what's often happening in our minds is magic. It is, you know, we're seeing things that are not quite real, but we believe that it's completely real. In my mind, that might actually be the most fantastic magic trick of all.
I agree in the way you describe that. I mean, I in the book, you write about how magicians and even amateur magicians come to understand the brain's limits and our desire to create a story about what we see and we don't see. And I read that to understand that our brains are filling in the gaps, right, in the illusion. And that is a very powerful thing that sometimes leads us down the path of self-delusion. Is that the right way to put it?
That's right. So in our daily lives, I think many of us imagine that our brains function like a computer or a camera or a microphone, that our brains are merely picking up the outside world and reflecting reality as it actually is. This, however, is not the case. Our brains are constantly, in fact, mediating between the outside world and the inside world and presenting to us fractions or versions of reality that can help us, that can guide us or nudge us towards certain decisions rather than others. Let me give you a couple of really simple examples. You know, when we eat something delicious, we experience it as being delicious. We say this food is really tasty. This food has it's really sweet. For example, we're eating some delicious dessert, and we say, "Oh, how deliciously sweet this is." There is no food in the world that actually is sweet, right? This sweetness does not exist in the outside world. Sweetness is merely the chemical signatures or whatever the food that we're eating interpreted by the brain to say, produce a feeling of sweetness. And the reason our brains do this, the reason our brains make sugar taste sweet or desserts taste delicious, is because in our evolutionary history, sugar and calories were associated with survival. And so our brains, which are the product of natural selection and evolution, learned over many millions of years that if they could create the delusion of sweetness in our heads as we taste something sweet, we're more likely now to go in search of things that taste sweet. We're more likely to consume calories. Those calories are more likely to keep us alive when famine strikes, as it often did in our evolutionary history. The same thing happens throughout our lives. We think our brains are merely processing reality, when in fact, in many ways, they're constructing reality and constructing reality in a certain way that nudges us towards certain goals.
I mean, isn't this, Shankar, also the reason that memory researchers began to understand that, as you've said, the brain isn't a camera, and we're not just recording what we see and then, you know, putting it into our brain's drive as we saw it? I mean, what we're doing is influencing and changing that memory from our own experience, right? And then every time we go back to get that memory, our perception of that memory is influenced by what we now know, maybe what the experience was. Does that fit too?
That absolutely does fit as well. Most of us think of our memories as a filing cabinet, you know, or a photograph that we see something and it's sort of burned into our memories. And nothing really could be further from the truth. Our memories, in fact, are constantly sifting the past and selectively remembering certain things and discarding other things. In recent years, researchers have really concluded that almost all memories are really constructed. So they're constructed in the present based partly on the past, but based partly also on our present circumstances and what we need in the present. You can see this in all kinds of trivial ways. You know, you have something very emotional happen to you in the past, you're more likely to remember where you were when that emotional thing happened. And again, this is because our brains selectively remember things that have emotional power attached to them, both emotions that are good and emotions that are bad, because again, in our evolutionary history, it was valuable. Our emotions signaled something important is happening here, either something good or something bad. Either remember it because you either want more of it or remember it because you want less of it. But it's also the case that our memories are biased by all kinds of things that are shaped by our present circumstances. So for example, when we think about our political allegiances, for example, we are much more likely to selectively remember the negative things that our opponents did and remember those things because they help us construct a worldview that is consistent with our political orientations. Sports fans know that when they look back at the world and remember past seasons or past events, they selectively remember certain things that paint their teams in the light that they wish to see their teams. And so all of this is happening automatically, unconsciously, all the time. The great delusion is that we believe that when we think back on the past, all that we're doing is remembering the past accurately, or even when we look at the present, that we're seeing everything exactly as it is.
Let me grab a call here from Elizabeth in Minnetonka. Hi, Elizabeth. Glad you called.
Hi.
What did this make you think about?
Oh, one of my most treasured souvenirs of my husband. 30 years ago, we were in Paris. It was winter. We went to the Marais and had breakfast. It was Sunday morning. And then we walked past a part of an alley where a street performance, a young man and woman. And the young man was commanding this little paper dancing man. And we were just astounded at what he could have it do, and we looked for the trick and we looked for the strings and we couldn't see anything. And finally we knew that it wasn't real, but we finally anteed up the $12, and that was, you know, 30 years ago. And then the young woman takes us behind and presents us with a little plastic sleeve with a little colored paper man and the strings. And we were just thrilled, though. We knew, and we thought that it was worth the money for this expert. The young man was just so expert at it, and we were so happy.
I love that story because it's influenced by the wonderful experience that you were having in Paris, and still is, it sounds like. Shankar, what are you hearing that?
Well, it is a wonderful story, Elizabeth. I will say for my own part, I often have this immense sense of wonder and awe when I see a good magic trick. But I am often disappointed when the trick is revealed to me, when the magician actually says, here's what's behind the trick, because I suddenly realize this thing that I thought was wonderful and magical, in fact, has a very prosaic explanation. This is one of the reasons magicians often know it's a really unwise idea to explain to your audience how the trick came about. The audience always wants to know, explain to me, how did you do that? How did that happen? The magician does not reveal this, not just because the magician is trying to hide her secrets, but because the magician has realized when you reveal the secret of how the trick operates, you actually remove the wonder of the secret.
Right.
In many ways, our brains function in exactly the same way. The fact that we're not aware that our brains are producing, in effect, a magic trick all the time, that our brains are producing these delusions and self-deceptions all the time, in some ways that allows us to maintain the fiction that we're seeing reality for what it is. Sometimes when we're shown the mechanics, the mechanism behind how the machine works, it's both wonderful because we sort of understand how it works, but it removes some element of the wonder that we experienced.
You know, Shankar, the other thing that occurred to me in Elizabeth's story is, let's say she and her husband had had a little argument over mm-hmm. breakfast, and suddenly the morning of walking through the Marais and having breakfast at this wonderful cafe wasn't so wonderful. I have a feeling, mm-hmm. you know, even that maybe she wouldn't have even purchased the souvenir, or when she, you know, retrieves the souvenir from her box of goodies, it wouldn't hold the kind of wonderful experience that it did. It's
That's
funny
right.
how it's all colored by just the wonderful atmosphere, right?
That's
of
right.
the moment.
That's right. And you know, Elizabeth remembered all kinds of wonderful details. She remembered exactly where they were, and that it was a Sunday morning, and that they had just finished, you know, hanging out, and they came by this thing in a little alleyway, and it's all very vivid in her mind. Now, it's possible that all of that is exactly the way she remembers it, but if you actually, you know, research studies that actually go back and ask people to probe their most vivid memories, people often realized when they probe it that maybe it wasn't, you know, maybe Elizabeth will find it wasn't a Sunday. Maybe it was actually a Tuesday. Maybe, you know, it wasn't in the morning. Maybe it was in the evening. Maybe it wasn't in the Marais. Maybe it was another part of Paris. You know, but all of these things are the feeling that she has in some ways is the feeling that she still has, I think, when she looks at the souvenir. That's partly what memory is trying to reconstruct. And so if there are gaps in her memory, if there are things that she is not remembering properly, her mind does not tell her, you know, I don't actually know if it was a Sunday or a Tuesday. I don't know if it was a morning or an evening. Her mind in some ways fills in the missing gaps because it's the overall story that she wants to reconstruct.
Shankar Vedantam is with us if you just tuned in, and we're talking about the science and the power of self-delusion. His new book is called Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. As he has noted, we are conditioned, I think, to think that I'm only going to lead with logic, rationality. That is the key tenet here. That's the way to live. And that there is a lot of meaning and power in a little bit of self-delusion. I used an example of, you know, watching a commercial and seeing a face cream and thinking, yes, that really could turn back the clock. That's okay, so you spend $8 on a face cream, but the idea that maybe you walk around and you feel better, well, that's a good thing about some self-delusion. Can you think of a time that you or, I don't know, someone in your family engaged in some completely harmless but good self-delusion? 651-227-6000. What do you want to know about the science of this? 800-242-2828. And reach me on Twitter at @CarrieNPR to John in Duluth. Hi, John. Thanks for waiting. What are you curious about?
Yes, I'm curious about the following. Can your guest define a distinction between a vivid and real memory and an equally vivid imagining?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a great question, John. The challenge, of course, is that we are mired in our subjective experience of the world. So when I remember things back in my childhood, for example, I, like Elizabeth a moment ago, remember that very vividly. I can actually see myself where I was. I can imagine the clothes that I was wearing. I know who I was with. I can imagine what it felt like, what it smelled like, what I saw, what I heard, what I tasted. These things are very vivid to me. Now, if you ask me, what's the way of distinguishing something that actually happened from something that didn't happen? The only way to actually do that is to go back and find documentary evidence. So, for example, I would have to go back and look at a photograph that I took at the time and say, does a photograph actually show me wearing the clothes that I thought I was wearing? Does it actually show me in the Marais, or does it show me in some other part of Paris? In other words, you actually have to go looking for evidence to back yourself up. Purely from a subjective point of view, it's not clear to me that you can tell the difference between illusions that seem real and things that actually were real, because they both feel exactly the same in your brain.
Shankar, I have been thinking about con artists lately because I've been listening to this podcast about a con artist in Hollywood. And I recently read about Sylvia Brown, the psychic. And we should talk about how psychics play on this idea of delusion and illusion. But Sylvia Brown would consult on the cases of missing children. A lot of police departments brought her in, and she would tell the parents these ridiculous, you know, these frightened parents, these ridiculous stories about how the child had been kidnapped into white slavery in Japan or was living somewhere else. She ended up being indicted on security fraud, and she was convicted on a lesser charge. Her books still sell in the millions. She is still very popular. I just don't know how to account for that. Like, she has been exposed for the fraud that she is, and yet there are a lot of willing people out there who want to believe that she has this kind of power. How do you explain it?
Yeah, that's a powerful story. I'm not familiar with the story, but it's a really powerful story. The way that I would explain it, Kerry, is to ask why it is that people want to believe in what she is selling. And I think in many ways, when it comes to delusions, including dangerous delusions, and delusions can be both useful and dangerous, I think we're often so upset by the content of the delusions that we don't stop to ask the next question, which is, what is the psychological function this delusion is performing? What is the role of this delusion? If I took this delusion away from a person, what would be the cost that they would pay? In a purely rational, logical world, all of us would want to see reality for exactly what it was. But in fact, most of us don't live in a purely logical, rational world because there are things happening around us that are constantly inexplicable or things that are outside our control. The example from my book that popped in my head as you were describing the case of Sylvia Brown was the story of something called spirit photography. When photography was first invented, this was right around the time of the Civil War, there were people who developed something called a double exposure. So you could take a photograph of someone, but you could superimpose behind that person a ghostly image of what looked like a second person. And the people who came up with spirit photography, would superimpose in the background, besides a person, you know, someone who was a relative, maybe a child or maybe a husband or a parent, someone whom they cared about. Now, spirit photography really took off during the Civil War. And the reason it took off during the Civil War is that for the very first time, you know, news about a battlefield and the terrible things that were happening on the battlefield were being shown to Americans in their homes because photography allowed you to show the blood and gore of what was happening on very distant battles. And for many parents, The spirit photographs allowed them to sort of see their children or the ghostly images of their children standing next to living people or standing next to themselves. And for many people, these images were a source of comfort. It's not surprising that if you're a parent, you want to imagine that your child perhaps has died in some distant battlefield, but you want to imagine that your child is still with you. So when you ask, why is it that especially in these very traumatic situations, someone has had a missing child, someone's child has died, why it is that people reach for these beliefs? It's because when we're confronted by the inexplicable, when we're confronted by the deeply painful, seeing reality for what it is often excruciatingly difficult for us to do. Some of us are able to do it. Some of us are able to see reality in the eye. But some of us want to look away. And when we look away, we often turn to people who say, here's a story that I can tell you that I can explain what it is that you're going through. You know, some months ago, Kerry, I went through something not quite on the same scale, but something quite similar. I suffered a medical problem. I suffered a retina detachment. And for your listeners who aren't familiar with this, it's a fairly serious medical condition. The retina is the screen behind your eye, which allows you to process vision. And when the screen comes off its hinges, when it detaches, you can essentially lose vision in one of your eyes. And I was several hours from my home in Washington. I didn't know of any doctors who were around. I finally found a physician who very kindly opened his practice for me at 9 o'clock in the night. And he said, you know, this is a very serious condition. You have to go into surgery almost immediately or you're going to lose your eye. I didn't have a chance to get a second opinion or to look up reviews. I trusted the man. As it turned out, he was a brilliant doctor, brilliant surgeon. He ended up saving my eye. But ask yourself this question. At 9 o'clock on that night when I walked into his office, if he had been a charlatan or a con man, would I have been less likely to trust him? And the answer is no. I would have been just as likely to trust him because my faith in him was not because of him. My faith in him was because I was experiencing a great vulnerability. And in that moment of great vulnerability, I was willing to grab on to whoever threw a lifeline at me. So when it comes to psychics, when it comes to people who pull off these cons, very often what they're playing on are the hopes and fears of the people who are coming before them. And when those hopes and fears are great enough, many of us will reach for beliefs that can be delusional. You know, there's the old saying, there are no atheists in the foxhole. And I think that communicates right. The same idea that when we are in the grip of great fear, great vulnerability, all of us reach for beliefs that in other circumstances we might be skeptical of.
The surgery went well, Shankar?
It did go well. I was blessed Good. To have a wonderful doctor, a great surgeon. He saved my eye.
Wow. On Twitter, a listener says, I engage in this happy self-delusion multiple times a week when I buy lottery tickets. I know people who have won jackpots. It could happen to me. Feels wonderful to imagine it will, better than Prozac. To the phones to Renee in Sioux Falls. Hi, Renee. Thanks so much for waiting.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering how this relates to eyewitness testimony. Obviously, the experience itself maybe would change, you know, alter how the memory, maybe their own prejudices. And then I remember watching or listening to an NPR program years ago that talked about how re-remembering the memory actually changes the memory itself, which makes me think of a case years ago of a lady who said that she pictured the rapist, you know, in her mind's eye, and yet it was proven through DNA that he was not the actual rapist, but she swore that he did because she could picture him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so eyewitness testimony there's been a lot of work in recent years showing the unreliability of eyewitness testimony, Renee, and it's useful for you that you brought it up. So in the criminal justice system, we often believe that the most persuasive testimony is when someone says, I was there, I saw it happen, here's the person who did it. That person is sitting right in front of me in the courtroom. And many of us believe that that kind of eyewitness testimony is really ironclad. And the reason we believe that is that when we interrogate our own memories feel solid. you know, go back to what Elizabeth told us about that wonderful memory she had in Paris, it's going to be very difficult for Elizabeth to look at that memory and say, that actually did not happen, or it didn't happen in exactly the way that I remember it happening. All of us have deep faith in our own memories. It turns out that in many ways, eyewitness testimony is unreliable precisely for the reasons that you're talking about. When police officers sort of re-interrogate people over and over again, sometimes they can lead people to remember things that might not have actually happened. I'm not suggesting that all eyewitness testimony should be thrown out. In many ways, it's one of the most important tools we have in the criminal justice system. It's just that we have to look at it very cautiously and recognize that it's prone to all kinds of biases.
I want to get a call here from Brian in, but we'll ask Shankar to think about it and come back to it on the other side of news. But Brian, I'm so glad you called. Tell us a little bit about your work. It sounds interesting.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I work out at REM5 Virtual Reality Laboratory here in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. And over the past couple of years, we've put over 20,000 first-timers into virtual reality. And what's so cool for us to see is that kind of no matter your age, whether you're kind of a younger kid who's kind of a digital native and plays a lot of games and stuff, or you're 90 and, you know, this technology is super foreign to you, everyone's brains have a similar reaction where it's like you are immersed in this experience. And so I wanted to call because I think it was a cool tie-in to, I mean, we literally sell illusions. And so it's kind of this form of modern magic that that we really love. And it's just a super powerful use case. So I was kind of wondering, too, about if there's, you know, we're interested in the brain science behind it, too. We just have more of our anecdotal evidence from working with people. But just wanted to call in and say that I think that really ties into our conversation here.
Brian, one question. So when you put people who come from all different experiences and walks of life into a virtual reality experience, do they emerge kind of telling you that they, I mean, do you hear commonalities in the experience that they say they've had?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's really people are like, it's like I was there. And so, you know, we're really good with, again, getting people into experiences that they'll be comfortable with to start. Mm-hmm. So one of the examples on that is an experience called The Blue, where it's kind of you're underwater, you're walking on the ship, there's fish and jellyfish all around you. And then there's this one moment where people come face to face with this huge blue whale. And I have pictures of people doing this experience, and you just get the same look on their face. It's just like, whoa. And so whether they say it out loud or you just see it, you know, in their smile, it's an incredible thing because it's ubiquitous. You know, anybody that goes into that will have a similar experience of just complete amazement.
Super interesting. I'm so glad you called, Brian. Thanks for that. Shankar Vedantam is with us this morning. He's the host of the Hidden Brain Public Radio podcast, and he's co-author of the new book that we're talking about, Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. We'll talk about virtual reality on the other side of news, but Shankar also has this wonderful chapter about falling in love, and we're going to talk about the science and the self-delusion and the power of that self-delusion. Back to the conversation now with Shankar Vedantam, the host of Hidden Brain and co-author of the new book, Useful Delusions. Okay, Shankar, back to virtual reality, which I've never done this. Have you?
I have. It really is remarkable that you put on these goggles and, you know, you're in an immersive environment, and it could be anything. You could be underwater. You could be in a distant desert somewhere. You could be in outer space. It really is. It's totally freaky. The thing that jumped out at me as Brian was talking about virtual reality is another kind of virtual reality that we don't talk about, which is the virtual reality that our brains pull off all the time. So we tend to think that the brains that we have and the eyes that we have and, you know, the things that we hear, that is actual reality. And the virtual reality, when we put on our goggles and our headphones and, you know, an underwater world is piped into our heads, that is made up reality. But in some ways, the reality that we experience all around us is also made up in this really profound way. And I'm not suggesting that it's completely delusional, but it's not an accurate picture of everything that happens around you. One way I like to think of this, Kerry, is imagine for a moment that you're not an individual, but you're a country. Imagine you are the country of Kerry, and you appoint ambassadors to go out to different countries. Now, you expect these ambassadors to come back and tell you all the things that are happening in these other countries, but you don't expect the ambassadors to come back and tell you everything that's happening in every country, because you're going to get overwhelmed. A good ambassador will filter what she hears, tell you a few things, a few selective things that she thinks that you needs to that you need to hear, and also tell you things that might guide your judgment and your decision making in a way that's going to be helpful to you in the future. This is exactly the role that our brains are playing all the time. Our brains, in some ways, are mediating between our internal needs and hopes and fears and the external world. I'm not suggesting that our brains don't see reality at all. I'm just saying that what we see in reality is actually a very filtered version of what is actually happening out there. And the reason and the way in which our brain does all this filtering is in order to guide us, to nudge us to certain kinds of conclusions rather than other conclusions.
What a great analogy. The country of Shankar, the country of Kerry. That completely changes the way I think about this. To a call here to Steve in St. Cloud. Hi, Steve. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Hi.
Sorry. What are you thinking about?
Well, my story is happened about 7 years ago, just shortly after my wife passed away after a long bout with cancer. And, of course, I'm grieving and missing her very much. And I'm sitting on a chair in the living room, and she walked into the room. I mean, she come out of the hallway from the bedroom area, and she walked into the room, and it wasn't like a transparent being or a shadow or whatever. I mean, in my mind, it was her coming in there. And, you know, I got up off of the recliner, and I called out her name, and I was going to give her a hug, and I got like 2 or 3 feet from her, and then gone. Now, what's going on in a person's mind when that happens?
Steve, was it comforting or was it frightening?
It was more comforting, but there was a certain amount of frighteningness to it. But
Shankar,
it was just
saying?
So real. I mean, it was just so real, and I have never seen.
I can hear that.
A one-time deal. Probably it was about 3 weeks after she had passed away.
Yeah. Well, Steve, first of all, I'm so sorry for your loss. It sounds like you loved your wife very dearly and you miss her terribly. Our minds do things all the time that in some ways help us cope with the challenges that we're facing. And perhaps, Steve, what you experienced was perhaps a more extreme version of this than that happens to all of us all the time. All of us have had the experience almost on a daily basis when we go to sleep. And things happen to us in our dreams that feel completely real. All of us have had the experience of dreaming something and then waking up and having the split second where you're not quite sure which is reality. Is the dream the reality or is the waking world the reality? And soon the waking world sort of reasserts itself. But during the dream state, it's useful to ask, why is it we're not skeptical when we see and hear things that are happening? Why is it that they feel so real to us? And it turns out that during our dreaming states, we have parts of our brain that normally can be skeptical, that fact check us, that in some ways have quietened down as we're sleeping. They allow us in some ways to engage in the imagination in all kinds of powerful ways. Now, sometimes you could argue that this kind of imaginative thinking can be bad for us. We can all, I think, come up with examples where the delusions that are produced by the brain can be harmful to us. But I can also see all kinds of ways in which our delusional beliefs about other people, especially the people we love, can also be very functional for us. And not just when they have passed away and that we imagine that they're still in the room with us. You know, I would interpret that, Steve, in some ways as being a measure of how much you cared for your wife, how much you miss her, how much you needed her. Your brain in some ways was materializing her because your brain in some ways needed her. You felt the need to be with her. And again, as I said, if you stop thinking about the brain as a computer, you think of the brain as being a mediator between the internal needs that we have and the external world. You can see how an illusion like this could be produced. But this is true for all of us all the time. Even when we're not going through dire circumstances, we're constantly interacting with other people, but part of what we're seeing and hearing is not who they actually are, but who we imagine them to be, who we wish they would be, who we fear they would be. Our own minds, in some ways, are constructing part of the reality that we experience.
I think this is a good moment, given what Steve said and how powerful that love and grief was for his wife, to talk about this chapter, about the delusions of love and how important they are to that experience of being in love and having a long relationship. You write in the book, an array of cognitive distortions also helps keep couples faithful to one another. People who are in love are quicker to denigrate potential alternatives to their current romantic partners. Tell us why.
Well, it's quite clear in some ways why it is our brains would want to keep us faithful to certain partners, right? So in other words, if we are constantly exploring, let's say you get married to someone and your brain is constantly going out and thinking about other people you could be with, that's not a useful recipe for you being happy with the person you're with. And if the person you're with is a spouse and you're raising children together, it's not going to be in the interest of your family for your brain to go off and constantly be thinking about other people you could get romantically, you know, engaged with or entangled with. And so in some ways, it helps with the brain not to see those potential temptations or threats. People who are deeply in love are less able, actually less able, if you show them attractive figures of people from the, you know, the opposite sex or the same sex, whoever they're attracted to, they would find attractive. People who are deeply in love are less likely to find the competition as attractive as the person whom they're with. And this is actually, you would argue, a very useful delusion. It keeps many of us in happy relationships. It's still a delusion because in some ways you're not seeing reality for what it is. But I would argue this is the kind of delusion that could end up not only making us happier, but keeping us in relationships over a longer period, allowing families to be more stable over a longer period. It might not be real, but it's very functional.
Call here from Pete in Minnetonka. Hi, Pete.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Doing good. Glad you called.
Yeah, thanks. Interesting topic. So I would like to have your guest maybe just talk through, I don't really have it. Well, I do have an experience, right? Which is deja vu, right?
No.
I mean, I think we've all experienced it. And I think you've kind of skirted the edges of it, but I would like to kind of ask that directly in terms of, you know, where you're in an experience and it's like, you're literally thinking, I have been here before, and you can almost predict the next number of seconds of what's going to occur. And then it kind of vanishes, right? And then everything kind of comes back to. So it's kind of like this straddling of being in dream state or virtual reality and reality, right? But it's very difficult to discern, did I really experience that before? And was that real? Was I right? Or, so I would just like to hear your perspective on that, of how to kind of, how do you carve that up a little bit? So,
yeah, what an excellent observation there, Shankar.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation, Pete. I don't know, Pete, if you saw a movie some years ago called The Truman Show. In the movie, it's a show about a reality show where the central protagonist is not aware that he is in a reality show. So all around him, you know, his family, his friends, his coworkers, they are all actors. He's the only one who doesn't realize that he is in a reality show. And the premise of the movie is, at some point will he detect that he is part of this mass deception that has been perpetrated on him. And throughout the movie, Truman sees sort of little gaps in the deception, little errors in the deception that start to prop up, you know, things that he sort of sees the sets being assembled before him, or, you know, things that are not quite right. And this sort of starts to give him a clue that part of what's happening is that he's part of this grand deception. When you think about a phenomenon like deja vu, or a phenomenon like, you know, the one that we just heard from the previous guest, who sort of saw his wife suddenly materialize in the room after she had passed away, we have glimpses in some ways of how our minds are actually working. The reality, though, is that our minds are constructing reality for us all the time. All the time. This is happening all the time. Even now, as you're sitting and listening to this conversation unfolding on the radio, your mind is constructing reality, and in some ways, it's assembling everything in real time. It's almost like a theater set coming together, being assembled in real time. The amazing thing is actually that your brain does all of this without giving you any hint that it's doing any of this. So, you know, we talked a second ago about virtual reality, about sitting with, you know, with the goggles in front of our face and headphones in our ears. Our brains produce these kinds of virtual realities without ever giving us a signal that they are slow. You know, all of us have had the experience of sitting before a computer and you're trying to run, you know, too many screens at the same time, and you see the little hourglass window pop up that tell you that you're asking the computer to do too much. Have you ever noticed that your brain never does this? That your brain doesn't give you a little window that basically says, you know, I'm buffering, I need 30 seconds to catch up with reality? The reason is not because your brain is a supercomputer that's always up to speed with what's happening. Is that your brain is really agile at basically allowing you not to notice what it is that you're not noticing. It basically hides from you all of the things that you're actually not keeping up with, giving you the illusion that what you're seeing and hearing and tasting and remembering is the world as it actually is. So when you have an event like deja vu, where you have the feeling like, I have been here before, part of what you're seeing in some ways is the mental machinery of the brain suddenly coming into view in a way that it usually is not into view. Usually the way in which our experience of time unfolding and events unfolding happens in such a way that we don't have the sense that we are ahead of the events that are actually unfolding. But sometimes this breaks down very much like in the Truman Show, and you suddenly start to see the machinery behind the illusion at work.
You know, Shankar, as I was reading your book, I was thinking about how this applies to politics. And I remembered that every now and then a movie comes out about a politician who can't help but tell the truth. And, you know, against all the odds, that politician is elected. There's a delusion for you. But the fact is that politicians learn early on that they can't completely level with voters or prospective voters, right? And part of that is, in some ways, we know that when a politician says, you can have this and you can have that and your taxes will never go up. I mean, we're in some ways on the illusion, but it's kind of an agreement, right? It's an unspoken contract between the voter and the politician. I'm not talking about just flat out blatant lies, but that power of self-delusion, I think, powers a lot of the political universe that we live in. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're onto something there, Kerry. You know, and again, I think when we think about lies and deception, we think about the politician who comes out and basically says, you know, I did not have sex with that woman, or comes out and sort of lies in some kind of an obvious and blatant way. But what really is happening on a much more regular basis is that, and this is true not just for politicians, by the way, as we communicate with other people, part of what it means to be a functioning human is that you take into account their views, their perspective, the things that they care about. So when I'm having a conversation with you, Kerry, part of my mind, what it's doing automatically is asking myself the question, what does Kerry want to talk about? What kind of audience does she have? What kind of radio show is this? And I'm presenting myself in a way that will, I think, be appealing to you and to your audience. Now, here's the illusion. As I do this, as I tell you what I think you might want to hear, that might be your audience might find receptive, I start to believe what it is that I'm actually telling you. So in other words, this stream of deception and self-deception actually runs in two different directions. As the politician speaks to her audience, and as the audience tells the politician, gives all kinds of signals that what the politician is saying is welcome, the politician, almost in a Pavlovian fashion, starts to believe herself, genuinely believe what it is that she has told the audience. So this is called audience tuning. The audience, in some ways, is tuning what the politician is actually saying. The audience, for their part, are also engaged in a deception, because as you like the politician starts to tell you things that you want to hear, you basically say, all right, this is the reality that I want to hear. This is the politician exactly for me. In many ways, it's useful rather than to see this as one side lying and the other side being deluded. It's easier to see this in some ways as a dance of deception and self-deception that's unfolding on both sides. Again, I don't want to let politicians off the hook, someone who's actually lying. But the truth is that in much of the cases that we see in politics, it really is this two-way street.
I mean, this makes so much sense in this way. And it's a really valuable way for me to think about it, because I cover a lot of politics and watch a lot of politicians. I mean, as in, this is not the politician looking out into the sea of eager, hopeful faces and saying, boy, I can really put one over on them. The politician is receiving, I think you're saying, signals from the audience. And shaping and influencing how they will describe and explain and commit to something. Is that right? Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. I mean, yeah. Think about two people in an interpersonal setting who are sitting across from one another in a cafe. You know, it's a moonlit night, you know, and they are, you know, young people, they're falling in love. What happens in that conversation? You know, you are partly saying and hearing what it is that you're actually perceiving reality, but part of what you're saying and hearing is tied to how you think the other person is going to receive what you're mm-hmm. saying and speaking, right? So you're basically mm-hmm. in this dance with this other person. And as the two of you fall in love, part of what's happening is you're constructing a shared reality. You're basically saying, here's a reality that we're building together. It's a dance of deception and self-deception. Now, we think of deception and self-deception as always being bad things. But again, if you think about the way these seductions sometimes unfold, some of these seductions lead to good things. You know, you actually fall in love with your soulmate. You're happily married for 40 years. You raise a wonderful family together. Your shared reality that you have built together actually produces good things. Now, I'm not suggesting this always happens. Sometimes you actually are talking to a charlatan. You are talking to a con man, and this person is actually trying to hoodwink you and cheat you. Far more common, I think, is what you just described, Kerry, where there's this dance unfolding between the speaker and the audience. The audience is shaping what the speaker says. As the speaker starts to believe what she is saying. The audience hears what they want to hear. They start to believe what the politician is saying. It's a dance that goes along where both sides are constructing this reality together.
Shankar, I caught myself wondering how you, with all of this knowledge you have about the power of self-delusion, whether you now let yourself, you know, how much you police your willingness to engage in self-delusion. Again, because we've heard in the show, there's a lot of power to it and there's a lot of good stuff for that. But do you catch yourself saying, Shankar, you're slipping into that self-delusion, bring yourself back to reality? Maybe you're short-circuiting it a little bit?
Well, I think in many ways, all of us do both those things at the same time. There are delusions and self-deceptions that I think we engage with, and there are delusions and self-deceptions where we step back and say, hang on a second, is the way that I'm seeing the way the world truly is, all right? So in other words, when we're preparing for a test, for example, all of us have the experience of saying, yes, I've prepared really well for the test, and I'm going to do well in the test. But there's a part of our minds that also says, hang on a second, have I really covered this part of the syllabus really carefully? Maybe I should go back and read this chapter in the textbook a second time. I will say that I think of myself as a deeply logical and rational person, Kerry. But as a result of writing this book, if anything, I think I have actually gone in the other direction. I've realized that there are some self-deceptions, some delusions that I experience that I actually realize might be good for me. The most profound of these might be my delusions as a parent. When my own daughter was born, you know, I had the experience that I think many parents experience of believing that my child was the most special child in the history of the universe. And all parents sort of experience this. And of course, when you step back and look at this, you know that it cannot logically possibly be correct, that millions upon millions of parents are all correct that their specific child is the most unique child on the planet. But this is a very useful delusion to have, because parenting is difficult, it's time-consuming, it's expensive, it draws a lot from the parent. I've realized that this delusion that I have about my child allows me to be a better parent than I would be otherwise. So it's a delusion that I have chosen to embrace.
Shankar, this was so much fun. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you so much, Kerry. I really appreciate it.
Shankar Vedantam's new book is called Useful Delusions: The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain.
Oh, no.
just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.